Welcome to the Global Development Institute podcast. Based at the University of Manchester, we're Europe's largest research and teaching institute addressing poverty and inequality. Each episode, we'll bring you the latest thinking, insights, and debate in development studies.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tania Bastia, and I'm a reader at the Global Development Institute at the University of Manchester. And I'm here with Professor Ron Skelton. And we're here to talk about our latest book that we edited, The Handbook of Migration and Development. So we're delighted that this handbook has finally been published. This publication marks the culmination of our collaborative work for the past 5 years or so. It was really our intention to bring up to date, when we first started work on this, Ron's work, which he started some 25 years ago. His really famous book that everybody knows on migration and development. And when we were having a chat some 5 years ago about this, and we felt that a lot has happened in the field of migration and development since he wrote his book. And it was really our interest to bring together some of the more established thinkers in this field, as well as those who are just entering and doing research on migration and development. And we felt that a handbook would be a really interesting way of coordinating a conversation and then making it available to a wider audience. So here we are now with a handbook that has 55 chapters and over 60 contributors from all the main regions of the world. So in terms of what we have tried to do and what you could expect to find in the handbook covers some of the more traditional questions covered in debates around migration and development, as well as some less obvious ones. So we have chapters on remittances, climate change, forced migration and housing, but we also have others on social remittances, transnational families, care and aging. I mean, in terms of how we approached development, we really took a broad definition of development, one that understands development to be not just about economic measures of development, but also one that is linked to well-being, citizenship, and broader social change. So we address questions of borders, rights, inequalities, and social reproduction. To some extent, we also extended the idea of migration by including internal and international migration, given that most people who work on migration and development tend to focus just on international migration. So we have a chapter that deals with both internal and international migration, but also some of the other chapters also include examples from internal migration. And this is something that we wanted to include in the handbook. A great selling point for the handbook is that it includes concise chapters which provide a really great introduction to the topics if readers are not familiar with these debates. And the handbook also includes an original in-translation section, which moves migration and development debates in cultural context beyond English-speaking countries. But Ron will say a bit more about this.
Thanks very much, Tania. It's Ron Skelton here. This has really been a huge and very challenging project. But it is nice to see it in its final doorstop or form. As you've emphasized that we took a broad approach to development, and that one of the reasons was we didn't want just to focus on economic development, because Bob Lucas, in his handbook of migration, international migration and development, has really covered these issues. And so we wanted to take this broad approach. And we wanted to take some new perspectives. You'll see when you look at the table of contents, we don't have any chapter on specific state-to-state migrations. We've gone down below to look at cities and the role of cities. And in the small contributions that come as part of this podcast, Lauren Landau will look at the role of cities in sub-Saharan Africa. But we're trying to get underneath the skin of the nation state. And we've looked at migration corridors and we selected 10. Now, some of them are those you might expect, big ones such as Mexico to the United States or from Kyrgyzstan into Russia. But we also look at some really quite small not so obvious corridors such as Venezuela, Trinidad and Tobago, or Bolivia, Argentina. And so we tried to cover various corridors around the world. So that we thought was quite a different approach to migration and development. And as Tanya flagged up, the last section is called Translating Migration and Development, because we, working in British universities, are very conscious of the dominance of it, of the English language. And we knew that people writing and researching in other languages may have had slightly different perspectives. So we tried to compile how French, Germans, Spanish, Latin American Spanish, and so on, people would have looked at migration and development. We can't claim, I think, that we've managed 100% what we'd originally intended. We do not have a contribution from the Arabic world, simply because we couldn't find somebody who might be able to be in a position to do that. And sometimes we realize that this migration development is very sensitive, and in some cultures, it's easier to write about it in English than in maybe the language of the region. But we had a go at this, and we are, I think, fairly happy with what came out. Sometimes it wasn't quite what we expected, but I think it's a useful contribution anyway.
The handbook is targeted at established researchers who like to have overviews of the main topics all in one place, but it's also a great teaching resource, and we are now trying to find ways to make the handbook and the content more widely available. So we're trying to find ways of making the pre-edited version of the chapters accessible to everyone. And in the rest of this podcast, we've invited four contributors who have written chapters for the handbook to say a little bit more about the chapters, because I mean, I really see the handbook as, or our role, Ron's and my role, as being facilitators of a broader conversation about migration and development, and most of the handbook is not really our work. It's the work of people who have written their chapters. So we've invited four of them to contribute to this podcast, and we'll shortly pass on to Lauren Lando, who's Professor of Migration and Development at Oxford University. Then we'll have my colleague Oliver Bakewell, who is a senior lecturer at the University of Manchester and is going to talk about his provocative approach to undocumented migration, really based on his long-standing work on migration in Africa. Following that, we have a contribution by Gioconda Herrera, who's an Ecuadorian sociologist and a professor at the Facultad Latinoamericana de Ciencias Sociales in Quito. Finally, Melissa Siegel, who's a professor of migration studies and head of migration at the Maastricht Graduate School of Governance.
All right, Lauren, thanks very much for participating in this little podcast and giving us your perception on this book on migration development. But for anyone out there who doesn't know who you are, Lauren Landau is Professor of Migration and Development at Oxford University's Department of International Development and a researcher with the University of Witwatersrand's Africa Center for Migration and Society. Without further ado, I'd just like you to reflect a little bit on a fascinating chapter you've put together with the title, The Informalization of Migration Governance Across Africa's Urban Archipelagos, which is an intriguing title. So what does it all mean, Lauren? Over to you.
Right. Thank you. I think what Caroline and I were trying to do in this chapter is really three things. The first is to try to draw out a sort of recognition that when we speak about migration and development and the policies associated, we need to be thinking at multiple scales. And these are both spatial and temporal scales, right? So development is often thought of as a kind of national process or an urban process. And we're saying, well, it is those things, but it is also a translocal process. And it is a process that you can often see connected in sort of dyads or in archipelagos. So a specific neighborhood connected to a specific village, not even a whole city at a time. Mm. And often it is then the policies that affect how those spaces work formal policies, informal policies that really make the difference. And indeed, the sort of second thing is like at that micro scale, it's often not, certainly not immigration policy or sort of economic development policy writ large that makes a difference. But it is often these kind of informal, sort of often very social things about a kind of ethos that emerges within a church or a Pentecostal church or within a family, gendered roles about how men and women should behave, stigma on those, which are often the ways in which people's imaginations are formed, but also the way in which their kind of behaviors are sort of regulated. And I think the last thing that we really try to get at is, what does this mean then when we start talking about development, certainly at an urban level? So what does it mean to think about development when the people in the city are trying to build a life at a later time somewhere else? So what ends up looking like poverty, what ends up looking like marginalization for that individual is part of their project. I'm saving the money so I can move on or I can go home. But from an urban development framework, it looks like a failure. These people are staying in poverty. They're in bad housing. They're in bad sanitation. Things are not improving. But trying to improve those things, which looks good from an urban perspective, often works against the migrant when they come, when they go, because they want a cheap place to live. They want a cheap place to move into the city and to move out. And it's a try to challenge this idea of what is the right to the city? What is urban inclusion? What is development? At what scale? At what time frames? And how, if we could even agree on those things, can it be regulated in the kind of spaces that these people live?
This is great because, I mean, you're in fact preaching to the converted here, because I'm a great believer in our need to focus on urban space, on subnational units, and where they're going and how they've contributed to development. Now, I just want to turn it a little bit towards the current view, because I don't think many of us could foresee just what's happened with this pandemic. I mean, what impact do you think that this might have on what you were looking at in sub-Saharan Africa? And if you were going to write the chapter knowing this, how would you change it?
Well, I think what we see in a lot of, when we're looking at migration in sub-Saharan Africa, there's this sort of big migrations, the people leaving for good that have gone off to Minneapolis or to London. But most of the migration is much more either across the border or within a country. And in many places, that is part and parcel of people's life courses. People from southern Mozambique coming to South Africa, earning money and going back so that they can get married. People from Zimbabwe, for generations, have come to South Africa to make money, and it's supporting families and their structures. And that imagination is now, and the practices associated with it, are under threat. These populations are already stigmatized as outsiders, as foreigners. Urban planners don't think about migration as something natural. They often think of it as a problem to be solved. And now with COVID and the restrictions that will come on mobility and interaction, chances are a lot of those things are going to be challenged. And I think if we're not able to get a handle on the disease, it's going to disrupt a lot of people's migration system, mobility systems. And it will not only mean an affront to their livelihood in the short term, but to a whole way of life and the way in which they understand their relationship to space, to development, to building futures. And even if the disease isn't as bad as we fear or doesn't have these effects, already we're starting to see responses from municipal planners across the continent and elsewhere in the world about locking people in, cordons and keeping them in dormitories. And that too, not only makes them more vulnerable to the disease, but disrupts the whole sort of labor, supply chain and imagination that's there.
That's great, Lauren. I thanks very much for your insight.
Oliver Bakewell is a senior lecturer at the Global Development Institute at the University of Manchester. You wrote a brilliant chapter, really interesting one, for our handbook on migration development on undocumented migration and development. So could you just talk us through your contribution that you wrote?
Yeah, thank you. So it was some time back when I heard about this project, I heard that you and Ron were pulling together a handbook on migration and development, and it sounded an exciting project. And I was very excited when I got this email inviting me to contribute. And then I saw what you'd asked me to look at, and it was undocumented migration. and my heart sank. Because this is a term which I've always felt rather uncomfortable with. It's used so much in Europe and in many other parts of the world. It seems often to refer to migration that's illegal, irregular, or otherwise unacceptable to states. And in particular in Europe, it tends to be associated with movement into the continent. It's a soft term, if you like, for illegal immigration. It's a, you know, we talk about in terms of smuggling and trafficking. And most of my work is on African migration. And when I tell people I'm working on African migration, they think I'm talking about undocumented migration to Europe, smuggling and trafficking and such like. And I didn't want to go into that. It's not the subject of my research. Because my interest is primarily on migration within Africa, which is the majority of movement. And I'd say it's much more important for African societies and economies and for development, if you like. So for me, taking on a standard focus of discussions of, about undocumented migration, talk about African movement towards Europe, wasn't something I wanted to do. It would reinforce a distorted view of African mobility. I also struggled to see how it would really fit with the other theme of development. So my first instinct when you invited me was to say no. But a bit more reflection brought me to the view that there was an interesting story to tell about how the idea of undocumented migration is spreading. In particular, undocumented migration as a problem to be tackled and how this had important implications for development. So rather than a piece debating the meaning, scale and implications of undocumented migration around the world, I ended up working on a piece that to some extent questioned the basic premise of the term. And it starts from my observations of my work in different African settings. In the chapter I refer to two, and the thought started with my earliest research work in northwest Zambia in the late 90s, where I was seeing the changing patterns of movement across the border with Angola, especially as the Angolan civil war ended and the country moved towards peace. And here I saw how people crossed back and forth without papers. And this migration was very important for their lives and livelihoods. It's how they got on in this very poor area. And the history of the region was one of migration. So I'd argued there that mobility was fundamental to local development in the sense of enhancing people's options, their capacity to make a living, improving their quality of life. Doesn't mean everybody moved, but the possibility was important. And an interesting and to me unexpected finding was that the normalizing of the border as the Angolan government gained control of the western side disturbed the informal, undocumented conventions that govern people's movements. So it reduced some livelihood options, in particular informal crossing for trading or cultivating underused land on the Angolan side. And none of these things might be legal in the sense of sanctioned by formal law, but they were known practices that were supported by local institutions on both sides of the border, in particular the chieftainships. So my second example was from more recent work in the Horn of Africa, where there's great concern about the scale of undocumented migration across various borders, especially where this might be the start of moves towards Europe. So this has sparked significant donor concern to invest in migration management, reduce the scale of irregular migration, tackle its root causes. And that's the sort of language that's being used, migration management and root causes. So my simple observation from research on the border with Ethiopia and Sudan, border cross at Metemba, is that whatever this concern about undocumented migration as the start of a very disturbing journey towards Europe, the major migration story is one of labour migration from Ethiopia into Sudan. So again, there's fundamental to people's livelihoods. There's an element of documentation, but it's not really meeting the formal requirements of immigration and documentation that would make it qualify as documented or regular migration. So these thoughts in mind, the thrust of my chapter is to question how far the undocumented nature of migration would be seen as a problem in itself. Instead of assuming that undocumented or irregular migration is necessarily wrong, we need to look more carefully at the context. Does documentation matter equally everywhere? How is different documentation used in border crossings, if at all? How important are informal movements for people's lives and livelihoods? What are the costs involved in enforcing documentation, given the potential barriers it may introduce to mobility? So I suggest that we should perhaps recognise the informal, undocumented governance of migration that goes on at many borders in poor, often remote regions of the world. And in the chapter, I put it as this, you can think of this, maybe it's regular or regulated, just not by states. So in the sense of regular, irregular migration. So it's important for development, but it should not be messed up to meet some global standards of regularity.
Since you wrote the chapter, a lot has changed and we're now in a very different world. I wanted to ask you, in what ways has the migration development changed with COVID-19? And if you were to write the chapter now, how would you change it, if at all?
It's obviously changed the world dramatically, and it seems very likely it's going to be used as a rationale to control migration more strongly. And we're seeing that everywhere, where migration was seen as, you know, we had freedom of movement, we now haven't. How it will play out in the sort of places I was writing about, I don't know. It's really hard to see. The idea that you can then invest more in migration control and somehow these borders, even without the disease, these borders have been, you know, they're not places of control in the sense of border posts and rigid control in the way that we see across European borders. And that's not necessarily a problem. And I wonder if rather than worrying about that, which has a very patchy record of session, maybe the thing is so much more about investment in public health. Because people in remote areas, they know about who's moving. They know about where people are coming from. And it's about making sure that they have the knowledge about how the disease spreads, about knowing what happens when people come into the community, whether it's from across a line or across from another part of the country. And it's monitoring the health of incomers and dealing with things like quarantine, which to some extent people are dealing with all the time. And certainly across Africa, I mean, it's remarkable seeing how they have dealt with much more dangerous diseases such as Ebola, which is absolutely terrifying in a different way to COVID-19. And that people, there are systems to manage that which maybe have been more successful than we consider. So I very much hope that it won't be used as an excuse to try to control the borders. And I think those efforts, certainly in the places I'm talking around, certainly somewhere like the parts of Zambia, Angola, very remote, it's not going to work. So and I think there's going to be a difference in how you deal with those making their own way, crossing informally, and those who come on buses and planes between major cities.
Gioconda, thank you very much for joining us. We are delighted that you've been able to join us for this podcast. Gioconda Herrera is an Ecuadorian sociologist and a professor at Flaxo, that's the Facultad Latinoamericana de Ciencias Sociales in Quito, in Ecuador. And her research interests concern the effects of globalization on social inequalities in Latin America. She has done work on international migration from the Andean countries to Europe and the United States, from specifically from a gender perspective. And she has also done research on transnational families and care, return migration and deportation. And her current research deals with the Venezuelan exodus in South America. The chapter that you wrote for the handbook is on care, social reproduction and migration. So what I'd like to ask you first is whether you could talk us through the contribution that you wrote for the handbook of migration and development.
Okay, thank you, Ron and Tanya, for inviting me for to contribute with this very interesting book. My chapter basically deals with the way the concept of global care chains evolved in Latin America, what was the use of this concept in migration studies, and basically in the relationship between gender and migration. And the chapter shows that the Latin American experience contributes to the literature on care, social reproduction, and migration, basically in two ways. The first one is to problematize the idea of care deficit, because I think we have done very interesting work in how family arrangements take place in the countries of departure and how, you know, women's migrant work are also very embedded in a colonial culture of domestic work, which adds a different layer of inequality to this global care chain. So I think these two contributions are important to highlight in the way in we understand the relationship between care and migration, because we are able to identify a dimension of social inequality that is not always so visible when we look at this kind of articulation between care and development, between care, migration, and development, when we look at countries of destination.
I really enjoy that part of your chapter, so particularly where you kind of shift the focus in the global care chains debates in terms of not necessarily understanding care as a deficit, but more as a reorganization of social reproduction.
Yes, I think that when we look at family arrangements and the way family deals with migration, with mother's migration, with father's migration, it's very important to highlight the idea of agency of and not so much of just a passive subject that is undergoing a very oppressive situation. I think it's very important in discussions on migration and development to interrogate this idea of deficit, and rather to highlight and make more visible the multiple family arrangements, and also to question the idea of family as we tend to understand, mm-hmm. of nuclear family. This is something that, from a gender perspective, this has been already interrogated in several works. But I think in the concept of care chain, you have to be very careful about not consider a care deficit as something as if we had passive subjects. So that's, I think, the most important. I think this is quite an interesting contribution in that sense.
Yes, and what I really liked is that then instead of that taking you to a place where you just see families dealing with the reorganization of people across different places and having to deal with that situation by themselves, you actually take us to a place where you talk about the right to care and you bring in the state. So I found that really valuable as well.
I think that that's also something very important to look at, is that it's not just about people and society and family arrangements, but there is a responsibility in terms of social protection. There is a right also to care, and also a right of to have this social protection. And this is something very important in our current context. That's one of the issues that I think are very valuable within this whole debate on how care is getting so important in our context, is that it was very invisible and very absent in discussions on social protection, particularly in Latin America. So I think migrants' work and the visibility of women's work on migration can help, or is one of the sources in order to understand how social protection is becoming, it's coming at the center of life. right now.
Yes. And I think that leads really nicely to the second question I have, which is that we're now in a very different world. I mean, when the book came out at the beginning of March, and so there is no way we could have predicted the changes. So we wanted to ask, in what way has migration development changed with COVID-19? And particularly, if you were to write the chapter now, how would you change it, if at all?
I think, well, that there are many issues. As I said, care is now at the center of a lot of inquiries. I would say that it's very important right now to look at what's going on with all these migrants, particularly from Latin America, that were countries where COVID was very high and very pervasive, like Italy or Spain. As we know, these are important destinations for Latin American women and families. And I guess that many of these women were within the care economy, and we really don't know what happened to them in, for example, England or Spain or Italy. I would say that it's very important right now to see what happened to this generation of migrant women, who many of them were in the care economy, taking care of the elderly. As we know, these are sectors that were very affected by COVID-19. And we definitely need to look at this global care chains through the eyes of this pandemic, and to look at how has been the impact on migration, first on these people in the countries of destination, but also what's going on back in the countries of origin in terms of remittances, in terms of how transnational links or transnational relationships may have changed, what happened to families in these new kind of interactions that COVID has brought to us. So I would say that I will pay more attention to what are the changes that the care economy is undergoing now, and what is the place of these migrant women who have been at the center of the attention and of all these activities of protection in this context.
Now, Melissa Siegel is a professor of migration studies and head of migration at the Maastricht Graduate School of Governance at Maastricht University and UNU Meret. And her research focuses on the causes and consequences of migration, with a focus of migration and development and migration policy and programming. Melissa, I think in some ways your contribution to the handbook of migration and development has turned out to be amongst the most relevant. You're dealing with migration and health. So could you just talk us through your contribution and highlight what you think is important, although understanding that, of course, it was written long before COVID-19.
Sure, of course. And thanks for having me on. And of course, thank you for the opportunity to be able to write this chapter in your highly anticipated book that is out now. So my chapter was really looking at the linkages between migration and health, and especially obviously now in this period, it's becoming even more relevant maybe than it was before. So what I wanted to do in this chapter is really understand different facets of how migration and health are linked. So for instance, first I look at the health of migrants in the countries of destination. Here, really understanding what kind of health outcomes that migrants have, both physical health and mental health, and what kind of determinants or what causes those different types of health outcomes, either from, for instance, selection effects through migrants maybe being more healthy in the beginning, to, you know, depending on the kind of jobs that they're doing, being exposed more to very difficult conditions where their health might suffer even more. both physical and mental health. Then I also look at migrants' healthcare access in countries of destination, which is extremely important. And of course, then migrants' legal status and their socioeconomic background also really plays into their ability to have good quality healthcare access. And then within the chapter, I move on to not just looking at what's happening in countries of destination, but also understanding what's happening in the countries of origin where migrants come from, you know, with the families that stay behind, with their households that are still back in the countries of origin. And there, again, I'm looking especially at health access and health outcomes that are very much linked to, for instance, whether or not migrants are sending back remittances, both financial remittances and social remittances. So things like new knowledge and norms and values also around health. And I look not only at these remittances, but it also looks at the effects of just the absence of a person in the household and how that could possibly lead to different types of health outcomes, or maybe put more pressure on the household in some regards. And then finally in the chapter, I look at the health of migrants during their travel or during their transit. So migrants don't always just move from point A to point B directly. Sometimes they have stops in between. These can be both intended or unintended. And again, based on their legality, based on their specific socioeconomic situation also, migrants can find themselves in very different kinds of health situations. So they could even be possibly bringing disease with them, or they could be actually ending up in a situation where they're much more exposed to illnesses or diseases that they maybe would have not been exposed to in their own countries. So there are a lot of things that are also happening in transit or in their journeys. And so I try to kind of cover these three areas. So what's happening in the country of destination, what's happening in the country of origin, and what also happens in that in-between period.
Yeah, I really like the structure that you took in your chapter. It's a very systematic and logical way to look at this whole issue. But the issues now, I think, and everybody will be asking, is that, okay, we're in a different world. And it was, of course, very difficult to try and foresee something as dramatic as the COVID-19 pandemic that's upon us. And I just wondered, if you're thinking about your chapter, how would you change it if you were to write it now? One of the things I liked in your chapter as well was the idea of a healthy migrant. So, I mean, how would you approach these issues now?
That's a great question. And of course, nowadays, given the current COVID-19 situation, we know that this is heavily affecting migrants, not just in a more general migration and development context, but absolutely in a health context. So as I, you know, in my section, when I'm looking at migrants and countries of destination, I mean, now we really have to see how migrants are in many times more vulnerable to contracting COVID, maybe because of the situations that they're living in. And then on top of that, many of them don't have access to the quality health care that they need because of their legal status or other situations in those countries. So I think, you know, the corona, the COVID situation right now and its impact on migrants and countries of destination is huge with regard to health specifically, but of course, with regard to development more generally. And that's a very clear and direct impact. If you would also look at it maybe a little bit more indirectly. So in the section that I wrote on, you know, how migration is affecting health of those who stay behind and households that stay behind, well, what we're seeing right now is that migrants are not able to work or not able to work in the same way that they did before, which means they're not having the same earning power and they're not being able to send back the same amounts of financial remittances. And so what does that mean for households that are, you know, staying behind, and how is that going to affect their health? Are they going to be able to spend money now on the same type of nutrition that they were having before? If they do get sick, forget even with COVID right now, with anything else, are they going to have the financial means and the resources to be able to access treatment? We know that remittances are more likely to be used for shocks or, you know, direct issues or problems than more like kind of emergency health care than necessarily preventative health care. So you can absolutely see now how the lack of remittances could directly affect the health of many of those households who are left behind. And I think we're going to be seeing that, unfortunately, more and more with the economic downturn that's definitely in place to be following this COVID pandemic.
Thank you very much, Melissa. I can see that in a few months you'll have a major research project on migration and the COVID-19 at Maastricht University. Thanks very much. Right, well, there you have had the perspectives of four of chapter authors. And just looking backwards and forwards, and I look back 25 years ago, more or less, when I published that book of migration and development, and how a different a world it was. And I think if we could look forward 25 years from now, it will again be very, very different. And what we do hope is that the chapters will help young researchers to look forwards, to try and see, or at least chart a pathway forwards to how we will see migration and development in about 2045.